Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jeffrey Kay, a retired clinical psychologist and independent journalist who examines President Trump's nomination of Gina Haspel to lead the CIA. Despite her history of overseeing the torture of U.S.-held prisoners and destroying evidence, Alexis Rodriguez of the National Puerto Rican Agenda, who talks about Puerto Rico's economic, energy, agricultural, and other crises, which plagued the island before Hurricane Maria struck last year, and independent journalist Eric Blanc, who discusses West Virginia's teacher strike and the significance of their successful wildcat job action for the broader U.S. labor movement. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On a rare visit to the Gaza Strip, Palestinian Prime Minister Rami Hamdallah's convoy was the target of a bomb attack near a border post with Israel. The prime minister, who was not injured, was on his way to the opening of a new sewage treatment plant funded by the World Bank and European nations. The roadside bombing triggered a new round of hostility between the Palestinian Authority and the Islamist Hamas movement, which has been in control of Gaza since 2007. The bombing occurred as the Trump administration was hosting a stakeholders meeting in Washington, D.C., to address the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Gaza. The Palestinian Authority, based in the West Bank, boycotted the meeting. For years, Israel and Egypt have limited access through Gaza's border crossings and effectively isolated the territory's 2 million people. Charitable organizations say that more than 1,000 Palestinians have died in Gaza due to the blockade, which has caused the collapse of the healthcare system with critical shortages of medicines and medical supplies. In recent months, the Trump administration has cut an estimated $300 million to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, or UNRWA, which provides funding for schools and aid to 5 million Palestinians in the occupied territories, Jordan and Lebanon. Yet, the UN agency was not invited to the White House stakeholder gathering. Instead, UNRWA and its supporters held a donor conference in Rome, which raised $100 million, substantially less than what is needed to continue relief programs that aid Palestinians. Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte is pulling his Southeast Asian nation out of the International Criminal Court, which investigates human rights violations and war crimes. In early February, the ICC initiated a preliminary inquiry into Duterte's war on drug dealers, which has led to the deaths of 12,000 Filipinos, many who were killed during police raids or targeted by paramilitary groups. Duterte, who many view as Asia's Donald Trump, complained of baseless, unprecedented, and outrageous attacks by United Nations officials, including a call for the Philippines president to undergo a psychiatric examination. Human Rights Watch's Parampreet Singh declared, Duterte has long shown a disdain for the rule of law. Specifically, the Philippines leader promised to pardon and promote police officers who carried out illegal killings. If the ICC concludes that crimes against humanity were committed by the Philippines government, leaving the ICC would not protect Duterte from prosecution. The Rome Treaty, which established the ICC, mandates that national governments must cooperate with criminal investigations, even if they withdraw from the treaty. Former NAACP President Ben Jealous is bringing a progressive agenda to the election for Maryland governor this November. A lifelong civil rights activist and ally of Bernie Sanders, Jealous is calling for free tuition at public universities, Medicare for all, and moving to a $15 an hour minimum wage. Jealous faces a crowded field in the June 26th Democratic primary. His biggest task is to raise his profile in a race without a clear frontrunner. The primary winner will face off against Republican incumbent Governor Larry Hogan. The former NAACP president has worked to improve ties with established Democrats by naming former Maryland State Party Chair Susan Turnbull, a Hillary Clinton supporter, as his running mate. Jealous first got involved in electoral politics as a teenage volunteer in Jesse Jackson's 1988 Rainbow Coalition campaign for president. The experience shaped Jealous in his work at the NAACP, where he broadened the group's agenda to confront stop-and-frisk policing, embraced the DREAM Act for young immigrants, and supported LGBTQ rights. According to In These Times magazine, Jealous has won early support from groups including Progressive Maryland and the state chapter of the Working Families Party. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In a series of cabinet shakeups, President Trump recently fired Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and then tapped current CIA Director Mike Pompeo to take over at the State Department, after which the president nominated CIA Deputy Director Gina Haspel to lead the nation's spy agency. However, Haspel's nomination has triggered a firestorm of controversy. The intelligence veteran took command of the CIA's covert detention facility in Thailand in 2002, where in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks on the U.S., al-Qaeda terrorist suspects were interrogated and tortured. It was at that site that Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded 83 times in a month and suffered other physical and psychological abuse. While Haspel was in command, another prisoner detainee, Abdul Rahim al-Nashiri, was waterboarded multiple times. Further, in 2005, Haspel was involved in the decision to destroy videotape evidence of the brutal interrogations. While the U.S. has signed several international treaties barring torture, both civilian and intelligence agency officials involved in the U.S. torture program have never been held accountable for their crimes. With Mr. Trump's nomination of Gina Haspel, the U.S. Senate will have a new opportunity to debate America's use of torture during upcoming confirmation hearings. Your reporter spoke with Jeffrey Kay, a retired clinical psychologist and independent journalist who has written extensively about torture. Here he examines issues of international law and morality surrounding Haspel's nomination.
We don't know everything about her. Most of this stuff is classified. I know people are asking, senators are asking for a full declassification of documents. Taking my sources from the Senate Select Committee of Intelligence's report on the CIA and the New York Times account, other accounts that have been written, she was, at least for a brief period of time at the end of 2002, in charge of CIA black site prison in Thailand known as Cat's Eye. And this was during the time that one of the prisoners there, Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, was waterboarded at least three times and tortured in other ways by the CIA. And so she was involved in that we know of. And then secondarily, a few years later, she had been promoted and now was chief of staff to Jose Rodriguez, who was the director of the counterintelligence service for the CIA. And the two of them kind of brainstormed how to destroy the, she was a big proponent, reportedly, of destroying the videotapes of the torture of both al-Nashiri and earlier, Abu Zubaydah, another early prisoner at the CIA Thailand black site. You know, this, of course, was a destruction of evidence of torture. So she covered up torture, and according to other people, she was quite the proponent of torture as well. John Kiriakou, who was a CIA agent in that part of the world at that time, was involved in the capture of Abu Zubaydah, claims in an article recently that people inside the CIA called her Bloody Gina, because of her proclivity for torture. That's who we're dealing with, and that's who Donald Trump has nominated to be the director of the CIA. And the importance of this is we now have somebody who literally is, if the reports are true, in fact, a torturer, to be the head of the CIA.
Summarize for us, if you would, the laws that have been violated by the CIA and the government that ordered the torture or authorized it, George W. Bush's administration. What are the essential things we need to know regarding the illegality of torture, regardless of the political rhetoric on one side or the other?
Right. During the Reagan administration, later Bush administration officials helped in the drafting of an international treaty that went through the United Nations, and that treaty became known as the Convention Against Torture. And the United States is a signatory to that treaty. In other words, the Convention Against Torture is the law of the United States, which is how our Constitution is written. If, you know, you sign a treaty, it becomes actually part of your law. And so whether you consider it domestic or international law, there are laws against the use of torture and cruel and inhumane forms of treatment, because the United States is also a signatory to the Geneva Conventions, which also have portions of it about the use of torture. And that, in fact, the United States, even at this very moment, and even under the Obama administration, was in violation of this treaty.
You have said of Gina Haspel's nomination, describing it as a moral depravity. What should Congress do here? What are their responsibilities here in handling this nomination by Donald Trump of a known and documented torturer?
Well, if they want, you know, they've asked for the documentation on Gina Haspel, and I'm all for the release of documents. That's what I'm really all about. And if they can use this nomination to get further release of details of the torture policies that went on in, during the Bush-Cheney administration of the CIA or any other current ones, I'm all for that. That's about all the good I can see coming from this, of course, and of course reject outright her nomination. But that would just be the beginning of what they should be doing, and this Congress is not going to take the further steps that need to be taken, which would be an investigation at least along the size and impact of the old Church Committee, and the and a really full-scale investigation of what's gone on in the past 20 years or so in relation to torture in the United States military and the CIA. There's been some investigations. They should release the entire Senate Select Committee report, of which we only got the executive summary. Thousands of pages, I believe, are still to be released, thousands of documents. We want to know the truth, and that's what people should be asking for.
It prompts one more question here. What signal will the Republican-controlled Senate send to the world if they confirm Donald Trump's nomination of Gina Haspel?
If they confirm Gina Haspel, the signal to the world is that the United States claims of any of being any kind of moral force in the world are a farce, they're a lie, and they should not be followed, period. That would be it. The United States will have given up any pretense that it stands for anything moral anymore because it's embraced the worst type of torture that there is.
That was Jeffrey Kay, a retired clinical psychologist and independent journalist who has written extensively about torture. Learn more about Gina Haspel's involvement in the U.S. torture program by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On February 24th, a group of Connecticut-based climate activist organizations sponsored a conference titled A Teach-In for a Livable World, Climate Justice Now. Sponsors included the Connecticut chapters of 350.org and the Sierra Club. A number of speakers at the gathering tackled subjects including environmental racism, labor and publicly owned renewable energy, population and development, women's rights, and more. One of the speakers, Alexis Rodriguez, is a representative of the Connecticut Puerto Rican Agenda and an advocate of decolonization. He spoke about the economic, energy, agricultural, and other crises that had existed in Puerto Rico before Hurricane Maria struck on September 20th last year. While water and electric power have been restored to most of the island, more than 100,000 homes remain in the dark and suffer frequent power outages. According to Puerto Rico's government, the storm caused an estimated $100 billion in damage, killed dozens of people, and damaged or destroyed nearly 400,000 homes. Over the 6 months since the hurricane, more than 135,000 people have moved from the island to the U.S. mainland. The destruction wrought by the storm greatly exacerbated the many pre-existing problems on the island. In his talk, Rodriguez asserted that the key to solving the island's problems is to take Puerto Rico out from under the control of the United States. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended and recorded his talk and presents the following excerpts.
Puerto Rico has been in a recession for 11 years. That's not a recession. I use that term because that's what economists coined, but really, Even an economist should know that 11 years in recession is a depression. Right? Puerto Rico is in an economic depression. And what we've seen, again, even before Hurricane Maria, is that the system, its political and economic system, has expired. It no longer works. This was before Hurricane Maria, and the hurricane just made that more pronounced. The energy infrastructure of Puerto Rico was archaic. The infrastructure has been neglected. When I mean neglected, by, you know, in regards to the maintenance of these power plants, in regards to any sort of investment to upgrade them. And 98% of the energy consumed in Puerto Rico is derived of fossil fuels. 98% is derived of fossil fuels. Let's also keep in mind that the cost of energy to the individual, the household, the consumer, is twice as much as it is, in some cases, three times as much as it is here in the Northeast. This in a place where most people live under the poverty line. To show you how ridiculous a lot of these efforts to privatize Puerto Rico are, In a meeting with potential investors, the governor of Puerto Rico flat out said to the investors that this is a smart investment to privatize Puerto Rico because consumers pay more than the consumers in the United States. So this is a good way for you to get rich. The nerve. We have people who still have no electricity. We have people. The suicide rates in Puerto Rico are damn near doubled since the hurricane. So the nerve to say that really just explains the mindset of the profiteering of the energy system here. This all in a place that has enough sun to meet its energy demand through solar power. The capacity is already there. There has been countless energy studies done in Puerto Rico that show that Puerto Rico can be fully solar powered. And I'm using the word crisis a lot. So there's a lot of crises that we're talking about here when we talk about Puerto Rico. So that's a little bit about the energy crisis. But I want to move on to the agricultural crisis. Puerto Rico is very food insecure. Puerto Rico is very dependent on imports. Before the hurricane, 85 to 90%, depending on what you found, of the food in Puerto Rico that was consumed in Puerto Rico is imported. 90% of the local agriculture was wiped out in the hurricane. So that only increased that dependency. Not only is that issue, we're talking about issue of lack of food sovereignty, we have a scenario where thousands of acres of agricultural land have been used for cultivation of genetically modified seeds and testing grounds for agrochemical development. Puerto Rico has essentially been used as a laboratory for a variety of experiments really throughout its history. You know, Agent Orange was tested in the rainforest in Puerto Rico before it was used in war. And that's just one example. Almost all of the water systems in Puerto Rico are not up to par to clean water standards. When I talk about a water crisis, it really does relate to other issues here in the United States, like Flint, Michigan. We're talking about the potential of Flint, Michigan happening on an island-wide scale on a place the size of Connecticut. Almost all of these water systems do not meet clean water standards. Some are not even subject to testing. According to the National Resources Defense Council, Puerto Rico has the highest rate of drinking water violations in relation to the United States. This is water. This is a basic need for human life. And this is the reality that we face in Puerto Rico. Continuing on environmental crisis, the majority of the landfills are over capacity, do not meet standards that are already weak. This has created toxic conditions where the garbage mixes with the rainwater, creates toxic gases like methane that affect the quality of air in communities throughout Puerto Rico. And it's no coincidence that most of these landfills happen to be in some of the poorest communities in Puerto Rico.
That was Alexis Rodriguez, a representative of the Connecticut Puerto Rican Agenda. He spoke at the February 24th teach-in for a livable world in West Hartford, Connecticut. Learn more about the ongoing crisis confronting the people of Puerto Rico by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On February 22nd, some 20,000 public school teachers and 13,000 school service employees launched a wildcat strike across the state of West Virginia. The teachers and their supporters were reacting to the state's proposed 1% pay hike for the years 2020 and 21, which they maintained wouldn't cover cost of living increases and a steep rise in health insurance costs. According to the National Education Association, the average salary for West Virginia teachers was ranked 48th in the country in 2016. Although a strike by public employees in West Virginia is illegal, teachers and service employees put everything on the line and struck anyway. The strike affected more than 250,000 students and closed all schools across the state for more than a week. But after 9 days, in disagreement between the State House and Senate on ways to settle the strike, the teachers' union emerged victorious, winning a 5% pay raise for all state workers, a temporary freeze on health insurance premiums, and a pledge to create a task force to address public employees' concern about rising health insurance costs. Your reporter spoke with independent journalist Eric Blanc, who covered the West Virginia teacher strike for Jacobin magazine. Here he discusses the union's success and the significance of their wildcat strike for the broader U.S. labor movement.
In West Virginia, like in most of the United States, public education and teachers and their unions have been under attack for years, decades. So you can look at this as straw that broke the camel's back. The attacks aren't new. What happened really this time was that the proposed changes, the proposed cuts to the health insurance plan, really the proposed mechanisms through which the health insurance in particular would affect teachers. Mainly the premiums would go up dramatically, and there would be a new program called Go365, which would be an incredibly invasive monitoring of teachers' health, in which if they didn't meet certain criteria or improve on certain metrics, their health costs would actually go up based on wearing a Fitbit-type tracking device. And so it was really these two issues in particular, when they were announced in November of last year, enraged really a layer of teachers in West Virginia that already were, as many people know, ranked 48th in the country in pay, who are already, you know, really on the edge of survival. In the interviews I did with a lot of different teachers, these questions of paying a few hundred more dollars in health insurance would be the difference between being able to continue teaching or maybe having to move out of state. So when these proposed governmental reforms to the health insurance came out, there was a lot of anger, and really that snowballed over the course of the last few months and it culminated in what we saw in the strike.
Eric, you've called this West Virginia teacher strike one of the most important labor victories since the early 1970s. What was unique about this strike that has you categorize it as such a critically important labor action?
Right. You know, unfortunately, there aren't too many victories since that time that we can choose from. There's not a huge number of labor strikes that have won, or labor strikes, period. But what made this different, I think you could point to three factors. The first was that it was illegal. And I think that shouldn't be underestimated. Even though the superintendents eventually came on board, the risks taken were incredibly high, particularly at first when nobody knew what the repercussions would be. And I think that fact alone is critically important, because so much of the labor movement throughout the United States for the last decades has been hampered by a legal system and a collective bargaining system that sets the union movement up to fail. And so much of the attempts to revive the labor movement have been more or less failures, or limited at best. because they've attempted to work within the parameters of the law as such. And I think that insofar as West Virginia ignored that and showed that you can have a successful strike despite laws saying that you can, despite laws saying that you can't take that form of action, it really points a new way forward, I think, for labor generally in the United States. You can take that as a model. A second point that made it different and really historic was that it was a wildcat strike, it became a wildcat strike. And so for listeners who don't know, that means it's a strike that's not doesn't have the formal approval of the union leadership. And that, again, is not something that we see very often. We haven't seen that since the, you know, in a widespread statewide level since at least in early 1970s. So on the fourth day of the strike, a deal was reached between the union leadership and the governor. It was announced that the strike was over, and the membership was told, you're going back to work on Thursday. The next day, on Wednesday, school after school on the Facebook group that people organized decided, no, we're not going back. We can't trust the governor. These are just promises. And it turned out that the wildcat really saved the day, because if they had gone back, the momentum would have been lost and the strike could have been lost. And then I think that the third and most exciting, in some ways defining, feature of the strike that makes it different than so many other labor struggles, successful or not, is that it seems to be spreading across the country. I'm not sure how much everybody's been following, but there's major pushes towards similar strike actions in Oklahoma, in Arizona, Kentucky, New Jersey. And so what you see is it appears to have sparked a nationwide public education movement, and that a strike wave in public sector and public education is not something we've seen. And the extent to which that catches on remains to be seen, and it very much depends on what people do in the coming weeks and months to make that potential for a strike wave a reality.
That was independent journalist Eric Blanc, who covered the West Virginia teacher strike for Jacobin Magazine. Learn more about the strike and its potential impact on the U.S. labor movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KMEC in Ukiah, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.